This conference will now be recorded.
So I'd like to welcome all of you here. This program is sponsored by the Association of Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders, also known as AGMD. The first part of the program, I'll be interviewing Dr. Abel. Melissa, everybody knows Melissa. Say hello, Melissa.
Good morning.
Melissa Adams Van Houten, she will be coming in with the possibility of questions during this interview part. After the interview, we will open it up to questions. And because of the high volume of people who have registered, we ask people to submit their questions via email prior to the program. So we'll try to take as many of those as we possibly can. So during the interview, we ask that you hold off on questions because we want to make sure that Dr. Abel can answer each question directly. For those unfamiliar with me, my name is Mary Angela DeGrazia DiTucci. I'm a longtime patient with pseudoobstruction, gastroparesis, achalasia, DES, GERD, malabsorption, and other non-digestive diseases. And in 1991, blessed to start this nonprofit organization, which serves as an educational resource for digestive motility diseases and disorders, and is a clearinghouse for members of the medical, scientific, and nutritional communities. In addition, we provide a forum for support for patients and their families suffering from GI motility disorders. And Melissa, will you just introduce yourself again and give a little description of you before I introduce Dr. Abel?
Yes, my name is Melissa Adams Van Houten. I'm a gastroparesis patient and advocate. I am also the patient education and advocacy specialist for the AGMD, and yes, we are working on shortening that title. I was diagnosed with gastroparesis a little more than 5 years ago and have been involved in advocacy and support groups online ever since.
We are so honored to have Dr. Thomas Abel here as our guest today. I met Dr. Abel in person many years ago, not as a patient, but he was so gracious in speaking at our very first symposium. And he's an extraordinary physician and humanitarian. And apparently he has a huge fan club from what I hear from all his patients. And I just joined that fan club. Dr. Abel serves on our advisory board and has graciously accepted our invitation to be our guest here today. Dr. Abel specializes in GI motility. He's been in the Mid-South for over 30 years. He's currently at the Arthur Schoen MD Chair of GI at the University of Louisville, Kentucky. Dr. Abel, thank you for being here today. To begin the interview, just to give those who don't know you, although I think everybody here does, but just in case is that one person who wants to get to know you, can you give a little bit more of your background?
Sure, yeah. I'm actually grew up in South Dakota. My dad was a college teacher, but my family originally was from Kentucky. 50 years ago, I was in college on the East Coast, and I was interested in people that had nausea and vomiting and was assured that it was a psychosomatic disorder. But it didn't make sense to me because I said, how can the mind cause that? Of course, what I was taught and assured was wrong. But that became a quest where I basically still interested in why people get nausea and vomiting, but more importantly, what to do to help them. So that's kind of the last 50 years and 60 seconds.
You have perfected the elevator speech.
Yeah.
But I know there's a lot more packed into that.
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
So what prompted you? I mean, you didn't have anybody in your family to become a medical field.
Right. Well, I have a lot of cousins who are physicians on my dad's side and my mom's side. But my dad was a college professor, and so I was interested in scholarly things. I also had a lot of people in my family with migraine, you know, which at that time was also thought to be a psychosomatic disease. We now realize that's not true.
Yeah.
So that's how I got interested in it. Originally was migraine-related problems, which still is about half our patients have migraine. It's a lot.
Yeah, that is a lot. Because so many patients have been told these symptoms that are stemming from their head. So it's so refreshing to hear you really on board with what the patient is. For those who perhaps have just been diagnosed, can you explain what gastroparesis is?
Well, it's a good question. You'd think after 50 years, I'd know. No one knows, but the underlying cause. But people, I mean, the word literally means delayed emptying, although I think a better delayed gastric emptying of food from the stomach. But I think a better definition would be disordered emptying or disordered gastric function. And the most common symptoms, as everybody unfortunately knows, are nausea, vomiting, and pain. But there are a lot of other symptoms. And for a lot of patients, it's a lot. It involves much more than the stomach. I call them gastroparesis syndromes because it's really a lot of, no one person is alike, of course, but there's probably 20 or 30 different ways that we, general ways that we see people that, in the office, for example, or a hospital. And it's I know myself, I remember 50 years ago, again, I was actually, I'm reminded this is the week of Woodstock. I was not at Woodstock. I was actually in the Amazon jungle, actually. some kind of infectious. And I remember telling the Peace Corps doctor, you know, I sort of histrionic, I said, just let me die. You know, it's so terrible, vomiting. And I've never forgotten that. But that was, again, that was 50 years ago. But it is terrible. It's a horrible thing to live with nausea, vomiting, and pain. And I really think that most people that take care of patients really have fortunately not experienced it themselves. But it's just really hard to describe unless you've been there. If you fast forward, if I can jump ahead, fast forward 50 years now, we've had about 13 years of the National Institute of Health having this gastroparesis consortium. And I think we're getting closer to understanding, not just describing, but understanding maybe why people get these disorders.
That's so encouraging to hear.
Because, again, 50 years ago, I was told it was psychosomatic. Even 20 years ago, before the NIH consortium, that started because of patients. You know, patients were writing the NIH and calling their congressmen and senators and saying, I've got this disorder. Nobody knows what it is. Nobody can help me. Please do something. So it was totally patient-driven and sort of political in a broad sense. Driven that this consortium got going, I think that's just reflects the increasing awareness of these disorders.
Absolutely, Dr. Abel, are medical schools addressing gastroparesis, or are they?
Well, I think there's. I'm sorry, I interrupted you, but are they addressing it?
Yes.
I think so. In a sense that. People understand physiology better now. I was fortunate enough to work alongside Dr. Guyton when I was in Mississippi, who wrote the textbook that I used in medical school. I wasn't there, but I was elsewhere. And he really understand the role of nerves and muscle and controlling the gut, also the autonomic nervous system, hormonal changes. a lot of things to control the gut. And now that we have ways to measure these things, we realize how disordered the quote physiology is of people with gastroparesis or the syndromes.
Some of the ways to diagnose, I know the gold standard is supposed to be the gastric emptying test. However, right. From what the patients say, there seems to be a disconnect in the method that's used at various facilities. So some places use a two-hour test, some use four. And the radioactive meal varies as well. Do you see this standardization of this test evolving, or another type of test that would be more specific and easier to define gastroparesis?
Yeah, and again, I'm hopefully it goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway. These are my opinions, and as I remind myself and tell patients, most things in medicine are opinions rather than facts. I use an example. Lincoln was born in 1809 or something as a fact, but he was the greatest president as an opinion. But so I'm going to give you my opinions. The gastric emptying test has a lot of drawbacks. Over half the patients with nausea and vomiting have, quote, normal emptying, which means it's not delayed. But we now realize that's kind of delayed emptying is kind of a late effect of gastroparesis and doesn't even occur in everybody eventually. And we now know it has to do with the interplay with the nerves and muscle in the gut, as well as the autonomic nervous system and other things. So for a given patient, and it's about half the patients that we see, they may not have disordered emptying, which I think is unfortunate in the sense that kind of subtly reinforces the idea, oh, gee, there's nothing wrong with me, or there's nothing wrong with you, which isn't true. But there are new, better ways to do gastric testing, and there are also other measurements, like I'm interested in electrical measurements. I spent the last 40 years working on that. And those changes, my observation, occur much earlier than the changes in emptying.
I see. Another thing is that a lot of patients, and this you pretty much explained it too, they'll go for a gastric emptying test and it comes back positive. They may go another time, now they have the diagnosis, and it comes back negative. So we try to explain to patients that just gives us, that's Melissa's little term, a snapshot of where you are at that moment. But again, the test has to be standardized so that all facilities are doing the exact same thing.
Yeah, well, that's one thing, because they're not all, you mentioned sometimes it's 2 hours, sometimes it's 4 hours, sometimes it's oatmeal, sometimes it's eggs.
Yes.
And not all patients can tolerate eggs. But you're right, there's variation in emptying like there is in anything. There's also variation for anybody, whether they have gastroparesis or not, during the day, what time you do it, you're emptying, your stomach emptying at different rates. Then they can be influenced by medications. There's all kinds of things. We did a study at our NIH consortium. We looked at people that had delayed emptying and people that didn't have delayed emptying and compared them side to side, published about 10 years ago. And they were identical in every way. I mean, down to the how old they were identical except in emptying. So it may be that emptying is not really the best test. It may be what we have. But and I'll talk maybe later. It can be important, particularly if it's very delayed, to rule out certain things. But I don't pay a lot of attention to the emptying. And that's my bias. I pay attention to the patient and their symptoms. That's probably a bias most patients share, but it's certainly mine. Some of my colleagues, you know, pay attention more to the emptying. Not that they don't care about the patient, but they're interested in the emptying. It's a different approach.
Yeah, and even with the gastric emptying test. I know some patients are affected by only liquids with gastroparesis, some only with solids, and some with both. So unless the meal is standardized with something and it includes both liquid and solid, I don't know if that would really depict which one or where you're at with what you're able to move through your stomach, correct?
That's right. There's solid and liquid emptying, and then the other part of it, the stomach really has two different pumps. It's an upper and a lower, and we don't generally measure the upper pump. Liquid empties it a little bit, but there is a way, a new way to analyze gastric emptying that looks at retention in the stomach, the proximal stomach. And not surprising to most of us, there are some people that have quote normal emptying, but they actually have retention moving up to the top of their stomach. And that's not picked up on standard emptying. And those people, a lot of those people have bloating, for example. Some of them have reflux. So there's interest now in trying to doing the test differently, as well as interest. We're doing a trial. The NIH is now looking at drugs to try to get the proximal or upper stomach to empty. So it's like so many things, it's complex. I just want to emphasize that people should not be disheartened if their emptying result doesn't correspond with how they're feeling, because in my opinion anyway, the most important thing is how they're feeling.
You have been a pioneer with the neurogastric stimulator. And I believe you were one of the first, if not the first, to implant that stimulator in a teenager. Am I correct?
Yeah, our team in Memphis developed the current technology that's used, yeah.
Yeah, so how did the neural stimulator, how did that evolve?
Well, that evolved out of sort of desperation, like so many things. We had, after I left Rochester, Minnesota, late 1980s, I went to Memphis, which was had about 5 or 10 million people in that delta between New Orleans and St. Louis. And a lot of them ended up in our clinic with nausea, vomiting, and didn't respond to medications, even investigational medications. So we got interested in looking at the biopsies and also biopsy of the muscle, realized there were a lot of abnormalities there, got interested in electrical activity, realized there were abnormalities, and so had the idea, which was not new to us, but had the idea of trying to modulate that with quote pacing, so like pacing the heart. This was 35 years ago, like, I was working on this. So we developed the current technique that's on the market and sold. But I can talk a lot about that, but its approval in 2000 by the Food and Drug Administration in the U.S. was for patients with their quote drug refractory, which unfortunately isn't hard because we have so few drugs. But it's particularly useful, again, my opinion, and I'm biased, for people that have failed everything else. We also do it a different way. We do it a way that's off label. We try it as a temporary trial first. Try before you buy, but to see if it's going to help or not. Without overemphasizing that, one of my other jobs is I'm an editor of GI editor for several journals. One's called Neuromodulation. And there are now about half a dozen different techniques being tried for neuromodulation for the GI tract. My job as an associate editor is to keep up with those and try to get them published. And so I'm very excited about that as part of the future for patients. Not just the way we do it, but there's going to be a lot of ways tried.
What is the criteria for becoming a candidate for the neurogastrostimulator?
The main approval by the Food and Drug Administration is not responding to medications. Now, fortunately, we've gotten more medications that are in trials. Hopefully, we'll actually get some approved for gastroparesis. So we have more and more that we can try. So that's good. Now, but the first step would be that. The second, a lot of our patients, as you know, are on nutritional support. And it's not necessarily a great life to have nutritional support as the way of maintaining the nutrition, but particularly for patients, that alone is not enough. Then that's the FDA approval for drug-refractory gastroparesis symptoms anyway.
So if a patient has another disease, they can still have the gastric pacer, correct?
Yeah, there's no reason not to. In fact, a lot of our patients have things that are common things like diabetes, but some people have a whole bunch of other connective tissue disease, or my own personal interest is rheumatologic diseases that present with GI motility symptoms, because that's a lot of those.
And what is the youngest age where you can do this?
Well, the approval age right now, I think, is 18 to 70. That's the FDA approval. We use it off-label in patients much younger than that. And there have been several hundred tried at a number of institutions in Columbus, Ohio, Gainesville, Florida, and elsewhere that have done large series, like over 100 patients at each center. I've been involved in some patients who are quite young. And if you look at the published data from the pediatric series, a lot of those patients are on nutritional support, and a lot of them are able to either get off or minimize nutritional support. So it seems like, looks like to me, like looking at the limited data, that the younger you are, if you try it, the better you may respond.
Interesting. Do you have any statistics as to what the success rate is for patients with that stimulator?
I can tell you the published data. The published data worldwide is if you use a success rate at 1 year is at least a 50% reduction in symptoms. Mm-hmm. It's about 80% people.
Wow.
That's been reproduced over and over. There's a smaller number that have a much higher reduction, and there's some that don't. That's why, again, we are on biases to do a trial phase and see if it's going to respond. But that's, again, many of the things I say are off-label, not approved. But under the Practice of Medicine Act in the U.S., you can, as long as you have a rationale, you can do things that are off-label, but the companies can't promote it.
I see.
But that's the data.
And what are the most common reasons why, if you know, that the stimulator does not work? Do you find like the commonality of it?
A couple of things. One is, and I think it's a good time to mention about what's now called obstructive gastroparesis. And I can give you my own opinions about that, but people whose pylorus won't open, for example, and that sometimes opening the pylorus can be helpful. Some of those patients greatly from that. There are some people that probably need a combination of opening the pylorus and stimulator, some that need the stimulator alone. That's an evolving area, but that I try to keep up with worldwide. There is a way to check the physiology of the pylorus, whether it's distensible or not. But what I think happens, and I think it happens with the progression of some people with gastroparesis, is they get scarring or fibrosis of the muscle. Mm-hmm. And we know from our NIH data that if you look with electron microscopy, look very closely at the muscles in people with gastroparesis, almost 100% of people have some fibrosis or scarring at a real tiny level. And if you get that scarring in the pylorus, then it doesn't distend, it won't open. And basically, it's like having a partial obstruction. So now some people are treating gastroparesis just with opening the pylorus, and I think for the right patient, that's very appropriate. But there is a technology. There's one technology called FLIP, functional luminal impedance tomography, FLIP, that shows whether the pylorus will open or not. If it distends, then probably it doesn't need to be cut. If it doesn't distend, if it's scarred, the cutting it may open it. So that's an important group. And many patients may have had that. I've seen people that it helped a lot, and I've seen people that it didn't help a lot. So that's one thing. Another thing is that some patients have a lot of inflammation on their full thickness biopsy, which is not easy to obtain. But if you're having surgery for any reason, my plea is to ask the surgeon to save a tissue, some tissue for neuromuscular staining, which can be done in any number of labs around the country. And again, if you have a lot of scarring, fibrosis, that can make you not respond to anything for as well as if you didn't have the scarring. I'm kind of going on and on, but there are another group of people that have inflammation that may respond to immunoglobulin. Immunoglobulin is a natural occurring substance that decreases inflammation. And some of those people have measurable antibodies in their blood against things like sodium, potassium, calcium, things that you might imagine. It's not a good thing if your body's, quote, allergic to sodium, potassium, or calcium. Then things don't work well. So there's a group of people that seem to benefit from immunotherapy. So there's a whole variety of reasons why stimulator might not be appropriate for somebody.
A lot of people inquire if gastroparesis is progressive. Can you respond to that?
Well, I can give you my own experience, and this is published data funded by the National Institute of Health, not as part of our consortium, but another grant called the Diabetes Complications. We looked at the mechanisms of gastroparesis, and one of the things, some of it's been published, some of it hasn't been published yet, but some of it has been. One of the things that occurs in a lot of patients with gastroparesis is systemic inflammation, things called cytokines you may have heard of. I joke with myself that there's cytokines and cytounkinds. These are the cytounkinds. They're involved with arthritis, psoriasis, ulcerative colitis, Crohn's, all these inflammatory bowel disease. These cytokines, they're also elevated in people with gastroparesis. And so if you have that ongoing, I mean, if you think of somebody like I've had family members that had rheumatoid arthritis, and you could see the progression of their joints being destroyed. There's pretty good reason to think that some people with gastroparesis have that kind of problem where it's going to progress. Other people don't. Sometimes if it's related to their diabetes and they get, let's say, an insulin pump or something, suddenly the blood sugars are much better controlled, may have much less trouble. So I think it can be progressive, but it doesn't have to be.
The next question I'm going to ask, in fact, the next two, are really hot topics that patients talk about all the time, and we talk about it. And that's about the weight issue with patients. Some gastroparesis patients are emaciated. Some are thin, average weight, maybe a little over, or obese. And is there an explanation for these variables? They can barely eat, and they have gastroparesis, and yet their weight fluctuates like this. They're all, you know, it comes in all different shapes. Can you give an explanation for that?
I think there's a couple of things that we know, and I have my own ideas. But for example, when I started working in this area 40, 50 years ago, most people were thin, but we also didn't have very good nutritional support. TPN was very new, and the nutritional support was not developed like it is now. So So some people get on nutritional support, and as you may know, it isn't ideal. Sometimes people overgain. It's because we're not nearly as good externally as the body is. But the other, not the other thing, another thing is the diet that patients eat, often very restricted. If you talk to people, they can, a lot of times can't handle, there are exceptions, but they can't handle vegetables well, can't handle protein well, or fat well. So they end up eating a lot of carbohydrates. And one of our published studies from the consortium was the average diet with the food, called the food frequency questionnaire, which is a standardized questionnaire. The average diet is 83% carbohydrate. When we think about that, as opposed to what we learned about in school, we all learned about this balanced diet that you're supposed to have, that's heavily loaded towards carbohydrates, and that can cause weight gain. It's like all you could eat are chips or something, and sometimes patients, that's all they can eat, the chips and soda. You're going to gain weight, and I see this all the time. Patients are so distressed, and I certainly feel for them, where they have nausea, vomiting, and yet they're gaining weight. It's like, how could this be? And then the other thing is that their family looks and friends look at them and say, well, how could you be sick? You know, you're not underweight, and you're a little overweight. And I'll talk more about that later. Another factor that we published recently is that the hormonal status for patients. I'm not just talking about people with diabetes, but it came out of our diabetes complication grant. Things like insulin and glucagon and amylin are markedly elevated in people with gastroparesis, and those can affect weight gain. So there's something that happens metabolically that also contributes. Because you see people, and I know they're right. They ate 500 calories a day, and they're still gaining weight. If you measure, there are ways to measure with what's called a metabolic cart. It looks at oxygen, CO2 consumption, oxygen consumption, CO2 output. And you can show that sometimes people have metabolism that's very slowed down. So I think nutritional support, carbohydrate loading, hormonal abnormalities, aren't the whole story, but I think it explains a lot of. And I explain that to patients, and I sometimes, if they really want to look it up, they can look up the articles and read about it and show their family and say, you know, I'm not the only one, because 2/3 of our patients in our consortium were either overweight or obese by BMI. So it's the majority, and they're just as sick as anybody else. Terms of symptoms.
How would patients be able to read or obtain a copy of that article, Dr. Abel?
Well, any of them, if they wanted to give you my email, or if you had certain ones you wanted, I could send them to you.
Or you can email, we can have patients email me, and then I can
I
give them to you all at once instead of you getting 100 emails.
You give me a few days, but I can get them to you.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we're slowly learning. But it's got to be very distressing to be so sick and yet you're gaining weight.
Dr. Abel, we just want to clone you. You're just such an understanding doctor.
Mm-hmm.
What is the status of domperidone now? It hasn't been approved in the United States for eons.
Couple things. I think in a different era it might have been approved. It was recommended unanimously for approval by the study section 20 some years ago, but was never signed off on. And I won't get into that, but it wasn't on a scientific basis. It's a drug that I think is very safe. It's used worldwide. You can get it to the FDA through the Compassionate Need Program. A lot of our patients get it outside the country, particularly from Canada. I don't know that it'll ever be approved in the U.S., but there are trials for some drugs that are very similar to domperidone. I know there's two or three trials that are about to begin. which I think is good because I think it's compared to metoclopramide or Reglan, it is much safer drug. And Reglan is the only drug that is approved, but it's not approved for long-term use and has the risk, small but definite risk of these movement disorders that are essentially untreatable. Domperidone has a much better safety profile. And so we're hopeful that some of these new investigational drugs will get approved because we need them.
Are you finding that there are common threads with gastroparesis patients? That's a question from somebody that had asked me.
Oh yeah. There are all kinds of things. In terms of other associated diseases, I mean, as I mentioned earlier about my own migraine, and migraine is very common. Interstitial cystitis is common. Connective tissue diseases. That specific diabetic complications. I mean, there are people that are not real common, but I see people that have like cardiac arrhythmias, for example, certain kinds of dysrhythmias that need ablations. Seizure disorders are more common. Movement disorders are more common. I mean, all these things. I don't think are an accident. They're common threads. And so, for a given patient, I think they're probably very significant.
We're running out of time. We could keep you here all day. So I'm going to just ask Melissa if she has any additional questions before I start going into depth with some of the questions that patients have submitted. Melissa?
Yes. In terms of the new research that's being done, can you speak to what areas that's focusing on? Is it focusing more on the causes of gastroparesis now than it used to be, for instance, or are there particular connections that they're researching, those sorts of things?
Sure. Well, in terms of research, well, there's a understandable emphasis on molecular biology, trying to look at particular genes that might play a role. As part of that, I have an interest in certain antibodies that may play a role. As you know, there's an antibody test now for irritable bowel syndrome, diarrhea predominant. So hopefully at some point there'll be something like that for gastroparesis. That's the focus. Certainly a focus on which patients need which treatment, you know, which ones might need medications, which ones might need pyloric therapies, which ones might need neuromodulation. So I think there's a realization that this diverse group of people that are labeled as gastroparesis, and if I can make an analogy to asthma, I'm not an expert on asthma, but I'm told there are 7 what are called endotypes for asthma now, and there probably are more. I can see that same sort of thing happen in gastroparesis, trying to think these are this is the type that you have, and thus this is the best treatment you have, instead of sort of one size fits all, which is kind of what it's been. Mm-hmm. So there's also interest. I mean, there's electrical activity. There's interest in ablating parts of the stomach that are electrically abnormal. There's data for that now, just like you do for the heart for dysrhythmia. So all kinds of things going on, and hopefully some of those will be helpful for patient care.
Do you think that it's possible that there's a genetic component that could perhaps be passed down? Could it be hereditary, in other words?
Well, I'm interested in genetics for a lot of reasons, but there certainly is a genetic component. Of course, genetic component doesn't always mean it's hereditary. There are families that are hereditary. There have been a couple families described, one with the specific chromosomal abnormalities. Those are rare, but whenever you see that, you begin to realize there may be more people that haven't been described. So I think there's certainly a genetic portion. Whether we'll ever identify clearly inherited characteristics of families, I don't know. But the way genetics is moving, I think if it's possible to identify it, that will happen. That will happen.
And one last question. You referred to it as more disordered gastric emptying than delayed gastric emptying. Can you explain that a little bit? What is disordered gastric emptying?
Well, we've known, for example, with diabetes, which is a long-term interest of mine because I used to work in a pancreas transplant program back 25 years ago. We've always known that people with diabetes, some of them had they didn't have delayed emptying, it was actually rapid emptying. And it's kind of like the heart going slow or fast. I mean, neither one are normal. You can get rapid emptying. And then we now know you can have disorders of part of the stomach. The proximal stomach retains food, even though the distal part, bottom part, does empty, the top part doesn't. So I think, and then I always have to add my interest in electrical part. There are electrical dysrhythmias in the stomach that are much like the heart. You get conduction blocks, you get reentrant phenomena. For all these disorders going on in the stomach that may not be picked up by a standard gastric emptying. So that's why I like to use the word disordered. We tried to use the word about 20, 30 years ago, gastropathy, meaning stomach that doesn't work right. It never caught on. It is an official coded word for ICD-10. You can code for gastropathy. So I use that a lot. But that's what I mean by disorder, not just delayed.
Good questions. Very good questions, as always, Melissa. Is Stacy here?
Hi,
Stacy. Do you want to ask your questions about, well, we've already pretty much answered any developing advancements on the improvement of gastric emptying time, but you wanted to know about helping with the symptoms. Can you ask about that?
Yes. So it's my understanding that the gastric pacemaker available now helps with nausea and vomiting, but doesn't greatly increase the gastric rate of emptying. Is there any devices, do you think, in the near future that would actually improve gastric emptying?
Well, let me first say, having spent my last quarter of a century on this, actually, if you look closely at the data, it depends on the patients. If you look at the so-called meta-analysis where you compare them, most studies do show some change in emptying. What we published and others published is it depends what the emptying was to begin with. If it's delayed, you can speed it up. If it's rapid, you can slow it down. So it's mostly a question of stomach itself and also how much energy you deliver. So to try to answer your question, with higher energies on a given patient, you can get the stomach to empty more. Unfortunately, improving emptying doesn't always correspond with the symptoms. However, so that's one of the quote just improving emptying. But yeah, that is the holy grail in the magical search. To try to improve emptying. But our other people have shown that in a given patient, you can predict whether you can improve emptying or not. So.
Thank you.
Is Laurie Hassinger here?
I'm here.
Okay, can you ask your question about GP and chronic pancreatitis?
Well, I just wonder, you know, we heard the doctor discuss electrical systems and heart arrhythmias and ablations and things, and I've had all of those things tied together, and chronic pancreatitis, and there's a lot of talk about dysautonomia and just the way the brain fires in all of these different systems, and just wondered about your experience with patients not just having one structural abnormality, but just having the whole system not work. And if that's the case, how does it ever really get treated if it changes from day to day? And is chronic pancreatitis, you know, tied to it? Do you see a lot of that?
Well, glad you asked. And my colleague, one of my passions is pancreatic disease. Okay. I'm maybe more as interested as anybody in that. We looked back at our NIH consortium and published this year. It's about 7% of our people have history of pancreatitis. As it turns out, I have a call on Monday. There's another NIH consortium called Diabetes, Pancreatic Cancer, and Chronic Pancreatitis Consortium that we're working with, because they see a lot of patients in their chronic pancreatitis consortium who have gastroparesis. So we're and the NIH, of course, is very supportive of the two organizations working together. We have a call on Monday on this. We're going to try to devise a way to look at those patients more closely and see what they are. Some people have had just one episode of pancreatitis. Other people have acute recurrent acute pancreatitis. And other people get chronic. So there's kind of three types. And we've seen all three types in our group. I'm extremely interested in this. And there's what we don't know is why it happens, but it clearly happens. It's not a lot, but it's about 7% or so of our patients.
Just ask one follow-up. If you're finding it that there might be a correlation, do you think that the correlation is due to like a dysautonomia where it's just something in the brain firing and there's no way to treat it?
Yeah, it may be. We didn't talk about dysautonomia, but a large number of people have dysautonomia. Probably up to 80% of gastroparesis have dysautonomia. And we published some data 20 years ago on, I can send it if you want, on pancreatic function and autonomic function, and they're related. So it could be related. Yeah.
Thank you.
We have a question from Nikki. Are you here? Nikki Morrissey? This patient has gastroparesis due to the severance of both her anterior and posterior vagus nerve. It's created so many other problems, including a cardiac pacemaker, malabsorption issues, severe visceral hypersensitivity, severe malnutrition, and weight loss. She was deemed a failure in a feeding tube trial at Mayo Clinic after being unable to tolerate 5 milliliters on a couple of tried formulas. TPN was a failure. It was pulling from her bloodstream and pulling into her tissues. She went through refeeding syndrome. She has multiple central lines that lead to several bouts of sepsis, no matter how careful she was. She now has been told there are no more options for her, and also she has global motility issue in her entire GI system and esophagus. She wants to know of anything at all that can be done to help get nutrients that she needs so badly. Her body can't process anything, it seems, and she thanks you.
Sure. Well, a couple of things. I'm sure sorry to hear that. One thing would be, I don't know with all the surgeries if she's ever had neuromuscular staining of a piece of tissue, but that might be real helpful to know. Second thing would be, there are some, and obviously she's been to excellent places, but there are some other nutrition support centers that she could consider. Nestle, that people have a fellowship program, and they have some training centers that I know of. And she probably is involved. Is it okay if I mention Oli Foundation? Can I mention
that? Yeah, absolutely. They're a wonderful foundation.
Yeah, I mean, if she's not, hopefully she's still involved with Oli, but if she's not, they're just unbelievable for, as you are, for support. And the other thing would be, I don't want to promise, but there are some people that have responded with various types of neurostimulation when the vagus has been cut. That's one group that sometimes is helpful. So I always hate to hear a story where people say there's no hope, because in my vocabulary that doesn't exist. So I think there are several things that I would recommend, and hope she can get some help.
Is Stacy Sawyer there? She has a question about, let's see, why is it so hard for people to accept gastroparesis can be fatal and cause other fatal issues? We light green candles for those we have lost, and she feels that they aren't taken seriously in the severity of gastroparesis patients.
Yeah, well, it's really unfortunate. I would say there has been a change. 20 years ago, people were saying, well, you know, gastroparesis, I know those patients are miserable, but at least nobody dies from it. I mean, I'm quoting somebody that's well-known. And then later, that person looked at the data and said, you know, they do die from this, and that's the reality, they do. And I don't know the reasons why people don't accept it. I mean, some of it's denial. We all deny things. Some of it's, you know, what a syndrome I call, you look fine to me, you know, like your weight's fine or you're overweight, you look fine to me, how could you be sick? I think there are all kinds of things that go into denial, but that's why it's so important to do, I think, the research and have the support groups like you do to remind each other that you're sick and you need help. And unfortunately, some of the therapies we do, like TPN, can be life-saving, but it has a risk, as do some of the other things we do, of infections, blood clots. Yeah, it's. So I don't know how best to answer that, but I think the medical community now understands that there's significant mortality with gastroparesis.
And you also touched upon that so many patients, they don't look ill. And so it's even hard for some doctors, as well as family members and coworkers and friends, to understand just how ill they are.
Yep. It's one other pitch I could make. I'm doing a survey now, but it's just something here through the IRB. But we're doing a survey of people, how they're treated in the emergency room, because really a lot of patients have what I call PTSD from not just the ER, but just medical care system in general. You know, they're not treated well, and sometimes things don't go well, and it really makes it hard.
Yeah. Is Linda Spinola here? She has a question, and the question is, sometimes she eats something and she won't get sick, but then she can eat the same thing 2 days later and be sick for days. She wants to know why.
I think that's just the variable of the illness, where something's so complex, how you manage food. So complex way to manage food.
Let's see, how much time do we have? It's 12:29. We have 1 minute. Honestly, I wish we could keep you here all day long. The questions are still coming in. We have a lot that came in on chat and a lot that are still coming in on email, and I'm so sorry that we can't get to all of them. But if you have a question, Dr. Abel, would it be okay if they send the questions to me and then perhaps I can shoot them over to you at one point?
Oh, yeah. My pleasure.
Oh, wonderful. Just see if there's anything else before I close. Melissa, do you have anything?
The first one I saw in the chat was if you could discuss what causes the bloating and how that might be treated.
The bloating?
Mm-hmm.
Was that the question? I think a lot of it is the proximal stomach not relaxing appropriately. And there are some drugs that can be used off-label for that. So we're doing a study in our consortium about that right now. So that's part of it, not the whole thing.
Okay, we are out of time. to our audience, I thank you for listening and learning and, of course, being inspired by Dr. Abel. And to Dr. Abel, my gratitude, it just cannot be measured. It extends well beyond forever. The recording of this will be on our website within a couple of weeks, and everyone should receive a notification when it is posted. Dr. Abel, you are such a beacon of hope and compassion and knowledge and dedication for so many people, and you are just so greatly appreciated. And to all the people who have gastroparesis and their families, I always say that you are the heroes. The courage to endure what you endure on a daily basis, the determination to persevere, and for making this organization what it is today. This organization belongs to you, not one person, and it's a platform to learn and share your voices. So from my heart to yours, may God bless you all. Thank you again. Take care. Bye-bye.